We got a theory. You see, Mike, we got a theory about magic and miracles.
That's right. That's right.
If magic is all we've ever known, then it's easy to miss what really goes on. But I've seen miracles in every way, and I see miracles every day. Oceans spanning beyond my sight, and a million stars way above them at night. You don't have to be high to look in the sky and know that's a miracle open wide.
Look at the mountains, trees, the seven seas,
and everything chilling underwater. Please, hot lava, snow, rain and fog, long neck giraffes and pet cats and dogs.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 12. No reviews, just analysis. A new week, with new things. I love new things. We'll be discussing three books from October 9th, 2013. America's Got Powers number 7, FBP Federal Bureau of Physics number 4, and Paul Pope's newly released graphic novel, Battling Boy. Read them first, or just listen to the show and try to keep up. We won't judge. For grief counseling, what am I talking about? There's no more grief counseling. That's hilarious. We do have Aaron's inner child, though he'll probably break the rules as usual. And in place of my weekly foray into the depths of despair, we're stoked to have writer Kelly Sue DeConnick as our first guest on the couch.
When I was a really little kid, I was a big fan of the Spider-Man cartoon. You know, the one with the classic Spider-Man. Spider-Man does whatever a spider can theme song. The song that was covered brilliantly by the Ramones, the song everyone knows the first verse to, but where everyone gets lost and starts mumbling before even catch thieves just like flies. So over the course of a few weeks, I studied and studied and practiced singing this damn theme song. Somehow I'd gotten it in my head that if I learned all the lyrics of that song and sang it to the girls at my school, they would like me. So I actually did it. And it took multiple attempts with different girls before I realized what a bad idea it had been.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Andrea nor I are remotely qualified to give professional advice on anything we'll be discussing today. So don't take it seriously, we're just here for the lols or lulls or lolicopters? I think kids say that, right?
I don't think so at all.
Oh. The theme of the show this week is hubris. By way of science, by way of man's constant struggle to catalog and control the natural power around us and within ourselves. It hardly ever goes as planned, but it makes for some great comics.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd stories, we want to celebrate the little geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. Share them with us, and we'll share them on an upcoming episode of the show. You can call, Skype, or email your story. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
And in between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Aaron Myers, and Andrea, at Andrea Shock, and of course the show account is at Comics Therapy. So Andrea, you seem in better spirits since the last time we talked. How was your week?
My week was pretty solid. I taught yesterday and today, which was awesome. It's been 2 months almost, so it's nice to see I still got it. And I had jury duty on Wednesday, which was bizarre and fascinating and a little bit terrible. So definitely an unusual week, but, like, I don't know, full of stories.
As long as you're not called for jury duty, like, one day to have to go down there isn't so bad.
Yeah, I had to definitely plead my case for why I was not fit to serve on the jury, because it was a 5-week long
You actually had to
trial.
Tell them they couldn't just take a look at you?
No. Despite numerous suggestions to the contrary, I dressed professionally and, like, kind of got my act together and went down there like a grown-up. I've never had jury duty before.
I've never had it either.
Well, so then who are you to give me advice on how to look slightly less crazy than normal?
Oh, I know how to dress crazy. I just don't know how to be a professional juror.
It was interesting, though. There were lots of things that I wasn't expecting. But for real, because it was a legit trial with... Did you know that, like, during the process that... the jury selection process, the defendant is right there. Like, the guy who supposedly killed another guy is, like, right there.
I did not know that.
I didn't either. I was a little surprised. So, yeah, I had to explain in writing why I was, like, not an appropriate choice for this upcoming trial, and then I was dismissed. But it was a little bit of excitement. It was a little bit of, well, it wasn't actually exciting, but it was mildly entertaining for a couple of hours on a Wednesday morning.
Yeah, I mean, you get plenty of good tweets from it.
I did.
In a modern world, that's all that really matters.
In fact, that's really how we measure, like, success, right?
Yeah. How many good tweets you can get every day.
Uh-huh.
That is the modern measure of success.
It's really a little depressing when you put it like that. Doesn't stop me from doing it. But
no.
Just saying. How was your week?
It's fine. You mean, mine's fairly uneventful. Bunch of, I'm just sitting here kind of with envy, watching everyone having fun at New York City Comic Con.
Yeah, I kind of hate everybody today. Yeah.
Yeah, looks like it'd be fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's going to be in my cards for many years.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated to plan a trip across the country for comics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unless you have your own private jet and, I guess, all kinds of accommodations. But
like a nanny or something?
Yeah. Yep. Cross-country comic cons are for people without kids.
Mm-hmm. Or older kids. I mean,
or older
in,
kids,
like,
I guess.
10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But I mean, it does look pretty excellent. I don't have the same, longing to do San Diego that I do New York. But also, I love New York, so
I don't think a lot of people do anymore. I think San Diego is a different kind of convention now.
Like, because all the people are there?
Just because it's so entertainment industry focused.
Mm-hmm.
And New York doesn't seem that way, or it probably has a lot of that, as I understand. But, like, Artist Alley is very busy, and it's mm-hmm. separated out, and it's, you know, it's heavily attended. And, like, you know, like, Seattle's another one. Like, I think Seattle is probably one of the best ones now.
Yeah.
You know, just for comics focus.
Are you gonna be able to come?
We'll see. I'd like to very much. We'll see how it works out.
Yeah. I'm gonna start lobbying more so than I have. Not just with you, because obviously the kid thing is still a factor, even, like, just going up the coast, but I do think that it sounds like a decent chunk of us are possibly going to make it to Seattle next year. So
yeah,
could be loads of fun.
I think so. I think the people that attend that too, from a creator standpoint.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's.
I had a blast last year.
Yeah. So that might be a distinct possibility, especially it depends on what happens with the Portland conventions too. I don't know if Wizards World's going to happen again. I hope it does.
Mm-hmm.
And same with Stumptown. I don't know what's happening with that. So that would make the beginning parts of the year pretty bleak for comic conventions.
For me personally.
I mean, that's all that matters.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's all I think about. Uh-huh. So other than that, just there were a lot of comics this week that came out. And it wasn't like last month where there were a lot of comics, but a lot of them were like the DC books that were somewhat entertaining, but not like really that exciting for me.
This was, like, just stuff you wanted to read?
Yeah, there was a ton of Image books and ton of independent books that I had just as many books this week that I've had in prior weeks, but they were all books like I really wanted to sit down and read, and kind of made for a very compressed reading schedule.
I'm behind, which is not a surprise, I don't think, to anybody.
Well, you've got all your West Wings to watch.
You know, don't hate. That show
No, I watched. I power watched that show when it was kind of over, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
If you revisit it, you will see that it is still amazing. It is still the best thing on television and absolutely responsible for everything I know about the way the government works. I think it's fine. Are you you ready for Aaron's Inner Child?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hold on. Now I have to find the fucking timer.
That was your idea.
It was, but it's going to be funny, so. Each week, I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. 90 seconds, one book, one new comic from the past week that we're not analyzing. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Go.
Okay, I'm not cheating this week. I want to talk about Afterlife with Archie.
Okay.
Because that was as good as I hoped it would be. And it's a lot of fun. It's, I would say this year has been like the first year I've ever read or purchased Archie comics. And I kind of started buying just cheap back issues, just to kind of have for when the kids got older, because I think they're a good thing for the kids to have around to flip through, and they're silly, and you know, they're good all ages books. But you know, I read a few of them. Like, Archie comics are fun. The really older ones, like the 60s and that sort of thing, are pretty crazy. But this is totally different. Afterlife with Archie is not a kid's book, and Francavilla's art is perfect for it. It's a fun concept. Like, I'm really impressed with what Archie Comics does these days. Like, even like a book like Kevin Keller or something like that. Like, they kind of push the social lines. And this is another, you know, zombie book, whatever. They're cashing in on it, but it's by an amazing creator. And it totally works. I'm really excited for it. It's like scary how a TV zombie movie would be scary.
So scary.
I think you'd be fine with it. I think you'd enjoy it.
Okay.
Because the characters are familiar, and it's perfect for this time of year. And it's
perfect. Oh, time is up.
All right. There you go.
So, okay, maybe I'll check it out. Probably not, but I might take a look at least the previews, because I've heard from a lot of people that the art's pretty awesome.
Yeah, Francavilla's art in basically everything. He's a safe bet for whatever you're going to buy of his, even if you don't like the story. It's worth it to see what his art is like.
Yeah.
He's pretty great.
He is.
Well, you want to talk about some comics we both read?
Yeah, that sounds like a better plan.
All right.
Hey, Comic Therapy. This is Scott Keys, like Car Keys on Twitter. Calling in with a real quick confession for you. I've been a huge fan of Rob Liefeld's art, and not in an ironic way. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Our first book this week is America's Got Powers, number 7, written by Jonathan Ross, art by Brian Hitch, and published by Image Comics. This is the much-awaited final issue of the miniseries that began back in the spring of 2012.
There are some thematic similarities with Brian Wood and Ming Doyle's Mara, which wrapped up last week. America's Got Powers also looks at the consumer culture that builds up around the phenomenon of an entire generation of babies in San Francisco born with superpowers. After riots, camps, experiments, and various other nefarious government interference into the lives of the young men and women with powers, the authorities have settled on a kind of extreme reality show format for the world to watch these super beings battle it out gladiator style. At the core of the story is Tommy, power level 0, whose twin brother Bobby was killed on the show's previous season. Tommy's girlfriend Debbie is an objector, a girl with powers who refuses to let her powers define her. When things go awry during the first episode of the new season of America's Got Powers, the entire world witnesses Tommy's rise from zero to hero, but still no one really knows the scope of his power, nor what it means for the rest of the population. Also, shady government interference is shady, and comes in a Sarah Palin-like package, which I'm sure is just coincidental.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
I forgot about that. When I was reading last night, or two nights ago, right? It was a shock to me. I had forgotten that it was so blatant, and I got a chuckle.
And when the first issue started, she was still, I don't think she's as much in like the consciousness of the nation as she is, you know, she was then.
Sure.
But still funny, and it worked for the character.
Can you think of a better, maybe Michelle Bachmann, but like what a perfect kind of iconic female anti-science, anti-progress right. Kind of visual.
Yeah, for sure. This is a pretty kind of like where Mara has some hope at the end. I don't want to compare the two of them because they're not really that comparable, but
no,
this is sort of a bleak commentary on society, entertainment society, and, you know, how we deal with the unknown and what we're capable of. And I think in the end, like, I kind of saw this almost as a non-American's take on American culture. you know, with a sci-fi twist to it.
Sure, okay.
But with the ending, I don't think it's... I mean, maybe you can argue that American culture is pretty pervasive throughout the world now.
Yeah.
But maybe it's even, like, the commentary is even more expanded. Like, you know, sorry to spoil it for people, but, you know, fine, we get rid of the powers that came and, you know, reset things back here in America, and then whatever aliens sent the crystals down just send it all over the world.
Yeah.
And I think almost in that respect, it's like, okay, well, what you did it once, but humanity's not going to do it over and over and over.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that it is exclusive to America. This obsession with the reality programming and the, I don't know, dehumanization of culture and all of the subtext that's happening here, I don't actually think that it's just us. I think that there are plenty of other examples in other media from other cultures. It's a problem with, like, humanity.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that it's not a dire point at the end of this miniseries. I think it's rather cleverly packaged, and I think that it has a lot to say about how we respond with fear to what we don't understand, and kind of seeing how it would have festered as these children grew up. And I love the kind of document additions at the beginning of each issue.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of give you a little bit of the like secret history of the government response to,
right,
like trying to keep this in check and control it when it's so clearly misunderstood. I think that's really interesting from a, I guess a, like an organizational standpoint. How do you respond to something that is so outside of the scope of what you've always dealt with?
Yeah, yeah. And in our case, Finding America's case, we decided to use it gladiatorially.
Right.
And, you know, that makes sense. I mean, that is not an American thing. That's historically, the gladiatorial, the battle, the thirst for blood, you know, the crowd wanting to have that catharsis,
mm-hmm,
for things that they're afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it, in a way, binds people together. It sort of goes back to Walking Dead in that way too, you know. And the governors, you know, give people something.
We're done with it.
But it does work. I mean, it's not, you know, it's sort of similar.
No, you're right, and there's a reason why it pops up in all of these different stories, because it has such a common denominator with, you know, history.
Yeah.
So it is. It's really disappointing when you think about the characters involved. Like, they're basically children. I mean, they're, what, upper teens, early 20s, somewhere in that realm.
Right, yep.
Have been, like, essentially, like, shepherded into this role where they're fighting to the death. And there's nothing real about it to the consumer or the viewer. But it's obviously very, very real to the kids who are living it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that detachment is really interesting also, like as a kind of sidebar to the way that the authorities are talking about these kids. Like, they're not talking about them like they're kids. They're talking about them as if they're commodities. They don't understand it. They want to control it. And they want to take advantage of the power in a way that benefits them as, like, humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're no longer talking about children or adolescents or whatever. We're talking about assets.
Well, and this is, in a lot of ways, it's a concept like that the X-Men have been kind of dealing with for, you know, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole idea of the separation of what was once human and now that homo superior, you know, in a
right
way. And then how does the rest of society deal with that? And then there are these super beings, and how do they then fit within society? And do we, if as humanity evolves and splits, do we stay benevolent? You know, that's that it to take to the I'm stuttering over it here, but that's the Magneto and Professor X debate,
right?
You know, where the humans need to be crushed. No, the humans need to be understood, and mm-hmm, they'll come around. And that happens in this, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a more compressed timeline because of the way the story is, you know, is sure. set up.
Sure. I thought the ending, though, I mean, separating the more crystals appear kind of epilogue, the removal of the question, like the taking back of all of the powers, I actually thought that was sort of sweet. That's not like the typical way that this storyline plays out. And
yeah.
there was something about that resolution that I found kind of endearing, given the extreme drama of like how rapidly the story developed from about the third issue onward, where just like super fast everything went just fucking haywire.
Right, and right.
There was more of a calm like ending that I sometimes like that. I do.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, it put a button on it. It closed up the story.
The guy gets the girl. Who can argue with that?
Yeah, no, I didn't. But it didn't feel trite or contrived.
Right.
I mean, it felt it worked, and it wasn't his evolution too. It was his growing into into an adult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to take on those responsibilities.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting character piece in that way, and you know, the government is always evil.
Always.
Always. Which, I don't know. I think overall it's a good story. It'll be good for people to read collected. It got a little disjointed just because of the release schedule.
Sure.
You know, it took a long time to come out. But
did you go back and read them all before?
I went back and read, like, the recaps of them.
Okay.
Just to remember after, you know, after reading the seventh. But
because I did, and I recommend it. There was a lot of stuff that I had forgotten, and It's a pleasantly packaged story if you just bust out 1 through 7 again.
Yeah.
There were definitely some subtle things with Tommy's development, especially, and with his relationship with his mother and with Debbie that I thought I personally benefited from rereading it. So.
Maybe I'll have to go give it a reread.
You should. You want to talk about more crazy government stuff?
Yeah, let's do that.
Hey, this is Random Shane calling in about my nerd confession, which probably the worst one was back in high school. This was 1989. I was having a time with my girlfriend, just hanging out. I was begging and boarding some comics, and she looked at me and she said, "You like those comics more than you like me." And I was like, "Yes, yes I do." That's pretty bad. Anyway, thanks. Bye.
Next up, we have The Federal Bureau of Physics, number 4, by Simon Oliver, with art by Robbie Rodriguez, and colors by Rico Renzi. FBP is published by Vertigo Comics.
Given the right circumstances, the impossible is always possible. Adam learned that from his dad right before the man was killed by physics. Awesome. So now Adam works as a special agent for the Federal Bureau of Physics, investigating phenomena that seem to indicate the very fabric of the known universe is shifting. He and his colleagues employ a variety of techniques to tame the scarier of the emergencies, like the total loss of gravity, for example, but they do a lot of cowboying around trying to figure things out too. When a bubbleverse pops up over a major urban area, Adam's partner Jay volunteers the pair to go in and rescue a man trapped inside. They only have a limited amount of time before the bubbleverse collapses and the shit hits the fan. But Jay is reluctantly working for a group that seems to want a catastrophic collapse, something that Adam only discovers when Jay tries to kill him.
So I love this book so far.
Me too! Me too. So good. Much.
Yeah. And stylistically and writing and everything else, I think it really works well.
It's gorgeous. I'm having a lot of fun with this one.
Yeah, and it's an awesome concept to bring up of using like science and physics specifically, like all these theoretical things, in a comic book setting. And if you really think about it, comics are the perfect medium for this,
right?
Because you can kind of explore all the impossible and all the theoretical, and bring it about. And to have this whole go back to shady government stuff going on in the background, it really makes for a compelling story.
Yeah, I feel like the approach to a world where the laws of physics are in question could have been like an everyman sort of story. And by not doing it that way, by looking at the response to like, holy shit, what do we do about all of this? It's really entertaining. It's really engaging and it's smart. There's no talking down about, I mean, it's comic book science, but it's still like, there are some fundamental kind of laws that they are referring to that I think that's good stuff. I like to be challenged.
It's not pretending like, oh, you know, wormholes. You know wormholes, right?
Right.
I mean, it takes real concepts and it doesn't over and like, oh, this is, you know, with a bunch of exposition or something.
Right.
You know, they show and don't tell as much, and that's the way you should do it, but at the same time it's not over your head either. Mm-hmm. And I think that has a lot to do with the art.
Yeah, I know that we just never talk about that part of these books, and I don't want to start that now, but like, dude, I love the art in this book. I think stylistically, when you're talking about something that isn't necessarily rooted in our world, you can have a little bit of fun with it, and you should have a little bit of fun with it. Yeah. Especially at those moments where the gravity is shifting, or the, you know, the bubble verse is collapsing, or things in the bubble verse are melding. It should look awesome, and it does.
Yeah, no, we don't have to go into how the book is built other than it's so fundamental to the story.
Right. You know?
And that gives it so much more weight that if it was just done kind of blandly, you wouldn't have the same kind of engagement. And I like the characters in this too.
Yeah. I think the reliance on the, well, it's going to be interesting to see how it develops with this kind of privatization of the physics industry or the physics emergency industry.
Yeah.
That feels a little bit more science fiction-y. I know that sounds kind of stupid, but when it was the government response, I don't know how to articulate this.
Well, you mean the privatization of emergency response? Like, yeah. the whole commoditization of, you know, insurance and that sort of thing.
Right, but for some reason, that part feels more comic booky and less kind of rooted in the reality that has been established in this story. And I don't want it to get goofy. I don't think it's going to.
No, I think it's more sinister. Like, yeah. that catastrophes are being manufactured in order to extract money from the populace.
Right. Right. You know, and that's cool. I can get behind that.
And there is very real world analogs to that already. I mean, you know, there are shortages in goods and commodities to drive prices up, and then, you know, they're relaxed. There's an industry of need in our world that mm-hmm. is very good. It is very good at being manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a good exploration in a very fantastical sort of way.
Right, right. But ideas. It doesn't ever feel so ridiculous that, and I think it just, like we said, it goes back to the way that the science itself and the phenomena themselves are presented.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, like The Massive too. There's some pretty intense and wild scientific things brought up in that, but they never feel, you know, they never feel fake.
Right.
And this doesn't feel fake. It just feels intense and exciting.
Right. And it turns out that is becoming more and more my favorite, or one of my top styles of writing and books that I respond to. So
yeah, and there's a lot of those books out these days that are really good, and they're not mimics of each other. They're each unique, and they're really taking some interesting looks at science.
And they're smart.
Yeah.
I really respond to that, to not being talked down to, being challenged, and then also the other trimmings are still there, like the character development and the, you know, like we said, the style. It's got to be the complete package, and this one's great.
Yep. I think I'm in agreement, and we're only 4 issues in, so there's only so much to talk about right now, other than I think this will be fun to revisit, maybe like at the end of like the second arc or something. Yeah,
absolutely.
So we'll get back to it. Well, you ready to move on to something I'm really excited to talk about?
Yeah, I know you're excited about this, and this is a new thing for us, because we're talking about a graphic novel. So, go for it.
Hey, Comics Therapy. This is Lucy Bellwood calling from Portland, Oregon. So, when you guys opened up the floor for nerd stories, I have a particular one that I'm very fond of that I thought you guys would enjoy. When I was in high school, I'm dating myself here, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie came out. Now, we all had feelings about that film, but that's neither here nor there. I was in high school, and I had a very strong group of nerdy friends, and we all decided that we were going to go to a showing in Oxnard, which, for those who aren't familiar, is the sort of coastal agro-industrial ass end of Southern California. It's not a hotbed of nerd culture or liberalism, let's put it that way. So we all decided to go to the showing because this is the only theater that's showing it near my tiny hometown. And a whole bunch of us, about 15 people, get together, including teachers and students, because I went to a weird high school, and we all dress up in pajamas and bathrobes and towels, and we head off to the cinema. And I don't often do the kind of dressing up for movies thing, but the experience of roaming around a Cineplex with a bunch of people in bathrobes was pretty priceless. So after hopping through the food court for a while and confusing a lot of people, the showtime's nearly starting, so we head into the lobby. As we walk through the door, an older gentleman and two middle-aged ladies accost us, and the man quite aggressively says, "Why are you dressed like that?" And we say, "Well, we're going to see The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy." And one of the women pipes in, "Is that one of those science fiction films? Marge reads those books, don't you, Marge?" And she goes, "Yes, well, you know, I like the aliens." But the man waves them aside and says, no, why are you wearing towels? And he seemed really upset about the fact. And my friend JR hopefully steps forward and says, "Well, you can do a lot of things with a towel. It's the most useful item in the universe. Why, you can sponge yourself off with it if you get soaked. You can use it as a comfy item to sit on a hard train seat. You can even use it to kill a man." And the old gentleman, without missing a beat, stares straight into JR's eyes and goes, "I could kill a man with my bare hands." There's a shocked silence after this. Everybody looks kind of confused. And then JR, to his immense credit, pipes up brightly and says, "Ah, but you could use a towel to clean up the mess afterwards." At that point, we kind of called it quits and filed into the theater and had the theatrical experience that we're not going to go into here. But I've always wondered why that old guy was so angry about towels. Anyway, something to think about. Bye, guys.
Lastly, this week, we're going to be talking about Paul Pope's newest graphic novel, Battling Boy. It's published by First Second. See, it's a little bit Thor, a little bit Rumspringa, with monsters and pulpy science. Acropolis' science hero, Haggard West, has fallen, but instead of his daughter, Aurora, taking up the mantle, the citizens are enamored with the mysterious Battling Boy, who seems to have taken out one of the monsters plaguing the city with a conjured lightning bolt. Except it wasn't him, it was his dad. Oh, he's God, all right, but he's just a kid, and his power comes from t-shirts. That's serious. So, if the monsters are organizing, Battling Boy and Aurora should probably join forces too, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly where this is heading.
Well, this was originally going to be, the two parts were going to be one bigger graphic novel. And I think either because he wasn't finished with it or they decided to break it up into two parts. So this is just part one right now.
Obviously.
Yeah. But I loved this. This is probably one of my favorite things I've read all year.
Oh, wow. That's quite an endorsement.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of things that are on high up on my list, but this is great. And, you know, while I was reading it, too, like, what I wonder is this something you would give to Avi?
I think so. I've been thinking about this, too, because my family, so my partner's aunt and uncle own an independent bookstore in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and I know that they have ordered this book for the bookstore. And so we were talking about where it should fit. Is this an all-ages book? Is this something that is more for adults? And I said, well, let me read it, and we're going to talk about it, and I'll let you know my thoughts. And I think at the end that, yeah, I think pretty solidly this is a true all-ages story. There's nothing objectionable that I felt about the way that the violence was portrayed. A lot of it is kind of off-camera. It's still happening, but it's not overwhelming. And that's a big distinction for me. The humor and the I guess the sophistication of the story is absolutely appealing to adults. And I think, yeah, absolutely, that this is something that I could pretty comfortably hand to Avi, with the caveat that then we're going to talk about it. The same way that we would with most any other true all-ages story, like Amelia Cole or Bone. It's not just something to hand off to him. It's like, let's enjoy this together.
Yeah. I think specifically, I'm sure you and he could discuss it fine. But in a way, I think it would be something like, if my sons were older, I think this would be fun to discuss with them.
Yeah.
As their father, because this is a son learning to be more independent and to see the world. You know, it's that coming of age story.
Right.
You know, in a totally fantastic way.
Sure.
But it is definitely something we all have to deal with. And that's that letting go, that's the son growing up.
I don't think it's one that I would read to a younger kid.
No, it would make no sense to a 3 or 5 year old. It's for 10 right. to 13 year olds.
Right. And it just so happens that my 8 year old, whatever. I tend to push him a little bit early with that sort of stuff. But mostly because evidence has shown that he can handle it. Mm-hmm. And because you're right, the conversation afterwards is like a really enriching part of the experience. And I wonder if, because a lot of the context that I found like extra kind of pleasantly appealing about the story and the references and the humor, and like, he doesn't have that same frame of reference. He doesn't have the same, you know, catalog of books and media to pull from himself. So I wonder if he would pick up on some of those.
Yeah, or if they're even important. I mean, the style is engaging for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, this goes back to how the book is presented, but it is such a comic book.
Yeah.
That, you know, how you get sucked into the story and the way the characters are portrayed and everything like that. I think everyone will gravitate to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I really like well-executed coming-of-age stories.
Yeah. It doesn't happen as often as it should, but
no, because it's hard to identify with that age group once you're past it.
Absolutely. But it's a source of great frustration for me as a parent trying to find more of that, like, for my own kid. Mm-hmm. So this is solid. And
maybe,
I think that
maybe generationally we're going to have more of those because we have a group of creators who are kind of, you know, in that age range with children who are looking to make things that their kids could relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bring it on. I think that would be excellent.
Yeah.
But I think I'm hoping that in the subsequent volume, there's the relationship between Battling Boy and Aurora has so much potential, like, you know, magic and science or whatever. It's making it very simplistic. But I think that story, that coming of age story, but also like fish out of water kind of story, is, it makes that development much sweeter.
Well, and that awakening, in, not in a creepy way, but that sexual awakening.
Wait, you're going to have to clarify how that's not in a creepy way.
Well, sexual, you know, like, because this is the age, like, when you start to notice the opposite sex or, you know, or whoever you're into.
You think that's what's going to happen here?
I think so. I think there's a potential for that.
How old do you think Aurora is?
I'd say probably pretty close to the same age.
Just
maybe
a little older. Yeah. Well, she says, like, whoa, you're younger than me. So I was thinking, I don't know, 14 or 15.
No, does she say that? Or that was like the model girl in the parade.
I don't think
like
so.
Like Miss Acropolis or something like that.
No way. No, it's totally Aurora at the end when she, like, shows up and she's got her little science gun and it's, like, her basically saving the day because turns out he can't conjure up lightning after all.
Oh, yeah. And she's maybe there was another part.
Yeah. Dude, I'm always right.
Yeah, sometimes. Except when you're not.
Right.
But I can't recommend this higher to people.
Yeah. I am hoping that, I know it's Battling Boy's story, but I am hoping to see more. That whole sequence where Aurora goes through all of the secret doors. And it's, like, the lab and the workshop and, like, all of her father's
experiments, and everything is based on like what he has discovered about how to kill these monsters. I thought that was awesome. It was like a very kind of Tony Stark moment.
It's also it's like a role reversal of kids, Superman and Superman and Batman, except for that Aurora's the Batman,
right?
And Battling Boy is the Superman.
Yeah,
and I like it. Yeah, so everyone go get it.
You were excited about this, though. It was like immediate as soon as you picked it up. I think you were like, "Hey, we're talking about this."
Oh yeah, for sure. So, I mean, this is a great book. Well, speaking of great things. So we have an exciting new segment on the show that we're calling The Couch, right?
Yeah, yeah. Time to move on?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Greetings, comic therapists. This is Roderick Roof, the man that can't be stopped, and I'm calling in for this week's Nerd Confession in regards to The Walking Dead 10th Anniversary Midnight Release Party that just took place across comic book shops nationwide. My confession? I almost forgot that it was happening. Turns out grief counseling patient Andrea Schott came to the rescue and was able to remind me. Guess she doesn't hate The Walking Dead that much after all. Ha ha. Thanks, guys.
There's been a lot of angst during the final segment of our show these past several weeks. And now we've reached the last stage in the process, acceptance and hope. We're leaving grief counseling behind and moving on. Welcome now to The Couch. A chance for honest and hopefully insightful conversations with some of our favorite comics creators who we respect and whose work we admire.
We're very excited to welcome our first guest, Kelly Sue DeConnick, writer of Image Comics' upcoming Pretty Deadly series. Kelly Sue also writes Captain Marvel for Marvel Comics and Ghost for Dark Horse Comics. She's given a strong, clear voice to Carol Danvers for the first time in years and is writing some of the best character-driven stories in the business. Thanks for joining us, Kelly Sue.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So our first question for you is, I mentioned some of the titles you're known for currently. Can you give us a quick and dirty rundown of any current or near future comic projects you're working on that you want to talk about? Just so our listeners get a sense and scope of the scale. You've got a lot of great stuff going on with a lot of different publishers right now.
Yeah, let's see. Pretty Deadly is coming out October 23rd. That's my first creator-owned book. And this is the first time I've ever been introduced where that was the first thing mentioned. So that was kind of exciting.
Awesome.
Just turned in 8 pages to Gail Simone for her Legends of Red Sonja anthology.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
That's exciting.
Yeah. I'm continuing to co-write Avengers Assemble with Warren Ellis.
Oh, fantastic. You're doing Ghost. Can you talk a little bit about the timing for that one?
The timing for that one, I am not sure when that is solicited for.
I know it was in previews 2 months ago, so it's probably coming out next month. I added it to my pre-order when it was in there. So.
That seems...
This is what Aaron brings to the table, ladies and gentlemen.
that seems doable. I'm looking at my project list here, which ones I can discuss. Oh. There's one I can't talk about. There's one I can't talk about. There's one I could talk about, but I probably shouldn't. It's a little early. Cartosia was just funded. I have a short for Cartosia with Ming Doyle coming up. Another short with Ming Doyle for Witching Hour at Vertigo.
Just came out this last week, right?
Yeah.
Last Wednesday. Yeah. Yep. This is my to-do list. I'm reading you guys. and then I have an intro that I need to write for a friend of mine's collection. So there you go. That's where I'm at.
Very busy.
Yeah, we both supported Cartosia. Aaron supported it before the Kickstarter even.
Aww.
But yeah, super excited to see you associated with that. Great project.
Something really cool about that. Really cool overstates it. Here's an interesting bit of trivia. Isaac Cates, who is the editor of Cartosia and is a Harvard grad and a comic scholar, was also in my high school drama club. We went to high school together.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Small world.
Isaac and I did UIL shows together. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Just to go back to Cartosia, for listeners who might just be jumping on now, we had Isaac call in and give us a kind of a breakdown of Cartosia Tales for the listening audience three or four episodes ago. It's in our show notes.
That's great.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So I need to ask this question about Pretty Deadly because I I'm not a Western fan, but I want to be. I'm excited now. I just want to know where that came from. Like, why a Western? Is there something specific about that genre that drew you to writing the story? I'm so intrigued.
Yeah, I have always loved Westerns. I think going back to, I have a vague memory of a Western I can't identify that I watched when I was a kid in the basement of my grandparents' house. And I think it was one of those things, it was like, I think there was like a card game going on upstairs, and they let me stay up a little extra late, and I was downstairs, and I wasn't supposed to be watching this show. And I was fascinated by it. And it was this is what I think is probably the origin point for both my love of Westerns and my love of revenge stories. I think it might have been the first female action hero I ever saw. She was, I know she was a gunslinger. I don't remember if she was avenging the death of her husband or her brother, or I don't remember it very well. I think it might have been Elizabeth Montgomery, but I'm also not sure about that. I know Elizabeth Montgomery did do a Western, but I haven't dug that up to watch it to identify if that's it, or even if I would know, you know? Like, there's a part that kind of doesn't want to see it, because I remember bits of it in flashes, and I'm not sure it's that I'm remembering it right, and I kind of don't want to be corrected.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I was very, very taken with that, and it's kind of stayed with me. And then, you know, and then there were a bazillion other Westerns I loved growing up. I love that kind of, I don't know, the tough guy thing. And I love vengeance films. Love them. And vengeance stories of any kind.
Yeah, there is something sort of base about the Western as a, like, forum for that story. It seems to be part of the standard formula in a way that I hadn't actually thought about.
Yeah,
I guess I have to go check out a whole bunch of Westerns now.
And I love the schlocky ones, and I don't even I don't even care. I don't care that High Plains Drifter and Pale Rider are the same movie. and so is, Rio Bravo and, oh, somebody's going to know. Rio Bravo and...
Are you thinking of like Shane or...
No, God, no. Rio Bravo, one of them has Dean Martin and the other one has Ricky... Oh, crap, you guys, I'm tired.
That's okay.
God damn it.
Well, I love the idea of the Western. It's a very American adaptation of the Japanese, like, samurai and ronin stories. You know, many of them are, but we've made them kind of our own. And for a long time, we really didn't have many good Westerns. And it seems like there's been a resurgence in the last year or so of really good Western tales either coming out or, you know, that have come out. And it's nice to have, like, the genre having a new life again.
Yeah. Well, most of the ones that are coming out now are sort of highbrow, which is a bit of a bummer if you're me.
Well, I've been really into, like, it's not really a pure Western or anything like that, but East of West, you know, Hickman's East of West is...
Yeah. Man, is there nothing he can't do?
I don't know.
Would you just stop it? okay, so Ricky Nelson was the other singer that's in the one that isn't Rio Bravo.
Oh, well played.
Yeah, well, it's okay, except I can't remember which is in which, so I'm actually looking it up on IMDb because I'm compulsive and can't let these things go.
You'll obsess about it.
Yeah. But yeah, there was also a film. Some listener will know what this is. There was also a movie that is, it's probably horrible about cultural creation, but there was some kind of, there were like kids racing across the desert. There was some kind of native component. I don't remember very well what that was either, but yeah, that stuff is, you know, I'm a kid, I'm a child of the 70s. There were a lot of Westerns. There was a lot of,
for me, it was Bonanza was on every afternoon.
Sure. Bonanza, and Big Valley,
Gunsmoke. Any of those got kind of ingrained in my early childhood.
Yeah. Wild Wild West. Oh my God, I love the Wild Wild West. So great.
There's a million.
Yep.
Aaron, you're going to have to make me a list.
I'm sure I'm not even the one to do. I'm sure we have a listener who will send you a list of top 100 Westerns you have to watch.
How about five? Give me five. Start with five.
Once Upon a Time in the West. Start there.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that in 25 years, but I remember it being really good.
Once Upon a Time in the West. I don't know. I hate to commit to this because somebody's going to be like rip me up one side down the other. Maybe The Searchers.
As a modern one, I thought Unforgiven is a great movie.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood.
Okay, now wait. Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson are both in Rio Bravo. So what the hell is the other one?
No. Oh,
Jesus, this is going to piss me off. All right.
I'm gonna ask you another question.
Okay. It's distract me. This is redirect. This is what we do with my kids. Redirect, right. Redirect.
Look over here. Look over here. What's this?
Uh-huh. Have you ever seen an elephant?
What are your writing routines? Do you have superstitions, things that you have to be in place for your process to really gel?
Not like lasting superstitions, but so there was one day that my kids went to a Jewish school for a while, and we went to a Purim party, and Tallulah put an adhesive gem on my forehead. And when I got home, I just kind of forgot the adhesive gem was on my forehead, and I had this incredibly productive work day. Like, I think I got like 12 or 13 pages written that day, which is a lot for me. And so I refused to take it off. I kind of just left it on there until it wouldn't stick anymore. I don't know. I decided somehow that was helping.
Did you just tape it now to the side of your computer and it's like always there if you need it?
No, see, that's what I mean. Like, once it fell off, I wasn't attached to it anymore. that was fun. No, I don't. I mean, I don't really have. I know that I am most productive early in the morning, so I try to get up before the kids, and that often means I get up. Well, I go to bed with the kids at 8. If I'm really behind and I'm really pressed and I have to, I'll go to bed at 8 and get up at midnight and then work until the kids get up. Usually, though, I try to go to bed at 8 and get up at 3. And then that gives me until 5:30 or 6:30, depending on how lucky I am, when they get up. And then I'm on mom duty until they get to school. And then it takes me a little while to settle back in at my desk. And during the day, you get tons of interruptions and emails. And so I tend to get not a lot done. I do things like load up my Tumblr and all of that stuff while I'm packing the kids' lunches in the mornings. And while I'm making dinner at night, I have my laptop on the kitchen counter and I do that then, usually. During the day, you know, there's always something you didn't expect to do. Like, you know, oh, here, this lettering pass is ready. We need you to look at it right now. Or, oh, hey, this one I just got was, we're going to put your script in the back of this trade paperback. You're cool with that, right? It means I have to drop everything that I'm in the middle of and read the 38-page script. Sure, there's no personal note there that I don't want out in the world, because, of course, everything in this industry works at the last minute and it needs to go out the door right now. And, you know, so I mean, the day ends up being stuff like that. So it's a rare day that I actually get any significant writing work done during the day.
Right. That's life with kids too.
Yeah. I mean, my kids are at school during the day, even the little ones at preschool. And then at 4 o'clock, we knock off, go get the kids, have dinner, have a little playtime. I get a minute to myself. Then we all climb in bed for stories. And then the kids, I tend to fall asleep before the kids do. he moves them into their own rooms. He gets his equivalent of my early morning work time is nighttime. Mm-hmm. And then lather, rinse, repeat. I'm back up at 3 at the desk, ideally.
Wow. Well, Aaron and I talk a lot about finding that balance between work and home and fun in our lives and with our families. Mm-hmm. And for us, comics are a really great outlet to recharge when our brains are full of all the other stuff. So I'm having a hard time figuring out when in your day you might have like your own little indulgence to de-stress. Do you do that?
I really don't. I mean, I should. I don't. Yeah, I don't know when it was. Oh, a year or so ago, maybe 2 years ago. I don't know at this point. Somebody wrote me something about like, you know, how do you find balance? I was like, dude, I don't. Like, don't assume for a moment that I have this figured out, because I absolutely do not. You know, for a while, and I think Matt is back at it, but for a while we were both going to the gym Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at noon, just because, you know, we were spending all of our time at our desks, you know, and it was getting to be wildly unhealthy. I'd put some weight on and just wasn't happy. And, you know, you can feel
right.
Discomfort, but, you know, I've over obligated myself. So I'm in a place right now where I'm trying to back off. I'm actually trying to pare my schedule down And then the long-term plan is to, you know, really pare my schedule down so that I can try to transition to writing more prose. I'll probably always have a comic going, or, you know, a series alternating, maybe, you know, an arc of this series, an arc of that series, and then go to prose, because the monthly, you know, the monthly comic that comes out 16 times a year is not, right. That's not a schedule I can keep the quality up, because I'm just not fast enough. And you know, maybe it'll get easier as the kids are smaller, but, you know, finding that quiet, fallow time that you need, you need to take things in so that you have, you know, I don't watch television. Almost all the reading I do is research. You know, I've gotten to the point where I am out of balance. Do not take me as, like, do not take my advice here.
Well, it doesn't seem like an uncommon situation for creators too. It's especially with the comics industry, it's like feast or famine, that you're really hot, and then sometimes then everything dries up for a while, and like people tend to, it's like everything that comes along they'll take, because you don't, you know, when you're freelancing, you don't know when the next thing's going to come.
You know, and I also, you know, look at, you know, Matt or Brian, and you know, Matt at one point was averaging 6.5 scripts a month.
Wow.
And I thought, well, you know, okay, then certainly I could do 4 a month. Nope, turns out I can't. You know, I am just a different person than Matt or Brian, or, you know,
And it's a creative industry too. Like, it's not a, you're not a machine.
Yeah.
So it's totally understandable.
Machines either. They just work differently than I do. Mm-hmm. And I know it is I live with them, so I know it is taking its toll on Matt, and in 6 months, 6 scripts a month are certainly not ideal to his way of thinking either.
Yeah.
He can do it if he has to. I could not do it. I could not make it happen. You know, I don't think I could even type 6 scripts a month, even if I never write them, you know?
Yeah.
Well, one of the other things that we tend to talk a lot about, and you started to get into it with the lovely story of your Western influence when you were a child, but I tend to dwell a lot about, like, childhood fears and adult anxieties, how they're influencing now, how we respond to the stories and the characters that we're interested in. So if you're not comfortable with it, you don't have to, but I'm going to put you on the spot and say, do you have a childhood fear that you're willing to share that you think pops up in the media that you do create, or that you, when you have a moment, will watch?
I don't know. I mean, I wrote a piece for the back of Pretty Deadly about falling. I remember I took gymnastics lessons very briefly when I was a child, and I have this very clear recollection that I started the essay in the back of Pretty Deadly with, of being on the uneven parallel bars, standing on the bottom bar, and we're meant to do a simple dismount, and the coach is there to like help our muscle memory through it, to like, you know, we're not, it's the first time, so we're not going to actually do it. He's going to catch us and carry us through it so we can understand what it is that we're supposed to be doing. And so I have both feet on the bottom bar. I've taken one hand off the top bar and put it on the bottom bar. And I am meant to let go of the top bar with that other hand, also put it on the bottom bar, and fall backwards. And I can't do it. And I remember this being like the first time that my body did not do what my head told it to do. You know, there was like, it was like, okay, and now I let go. And my hand was like, oh, no, that's not going to happen. And and I just kind of stayed there until they let me get down. And that was another thing, too, was, and I didn't put this in the piece, but I do remember that there was, like, this rule at the gym that if you said I can't, you had to do, like, 50 push-ups or something. and so I just quit.
I feel the same way about push-ups now.
I'm not going to fall backwards off the bar. That's not going to happen. And then I just went and got my mom and we left. And I don't remember it as being particularly shameful. Like, I remember thinking that something the coach said was mean, but I wasn't wounded by it. I didn't care.
That's good.
And the thing that I wrote in the essay is that children long to know themselves. And this is something I see in my own kids. Like my own kids are very fascinated by something that they can say about themselves, you know, that's why they make lists of favorites, you know, and it's part of constructing their identities. Children are so interested in like ethnic backgrounds. I came from this. This is my, you know, it's all about how we build this idea of who we are. Right. And I remember thinking that I had this, that I knew something new about myself. The next time someone asked me what I was afraid of, I could tell them I'm afraid of falling.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question then. You know, when speaking of kids, what's one dream you have for your kids? Like what I mean by that, you know, I'm a relatively new father. My oldest is 3 and we have a 4-month-old. And I can't really help but have hopes and dreams and hope for experiences that they have in life. I try very hard not to put that onto them. And I don't know how successful I'll be going forward, but, you know, what about you? Like, do you have a hope and dream? Like what's one that you would love for them to have?
Man, I mean, it's as cliche as this is, I really don't care. I just want my kids to be happy. There are some things that I hope to equip them with that I think will help them be happy. You know, I want them to learn to be wrong. I want them to learn to make mistakes and not to feel shame in it, to just learn from it and move on. I think that is a thing that we have to actively teach our children, and we don't. Culturally, we don't.
Yeah, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. My son is 8, and so more and more we're dealing with things from school and just from kind of middle childhood years that success and failure at that age has there are big consequences. And it's important that both success and failure are like nurtured.
Yeah. I was in my late 20s, early 30s before I learned how to be wrong, you know, and I don't want that for them. Mm-hmm. I want them to understand that much sooner. And, you know, my daughter is very spirited and very forceful and has a good sense of herself. And I think that gets crushed out of little girls. And I'm prepared to fiercely defend that for her.
Great.
So one dream I have for my children is that my daughter maintains that fire.
I think that's a perfectly acceptable hope and dream. well, on the lighter note, getting back to comics, what's one comic you think people should be reading right now besides your own, and why? And if you want to list more than one, you can.
Besides my own?
We're already reading yours. So what else should we be reading?
Princeless. You know Princeless?
Oh, yeah. I like Princeless.
Absolutely. Yeah. East of West, we already talked about. You guys should pick up Velvet.
I've pre-ordered it.
Yep.
Lazarus.
Yes. We love that.
Let's see. You know, I just got sent Umbral, but I haven't read it yet. But I'm excited for that one. Anthony's a friend and very gifted, I think. Let's see. Somebody else just told me about a thing I'm looking forward to now. Hold on, let me see if I can find the name of it. You know what? Actually, I don't know if it's announced, so never mind.
Well, you already given us a pretty good list.
Yeah.
Isn't that awkward?
Well, thank you so much for making time to talk with us today, Kelly Sue, and for being an awesome role model as a parent and in the industry. Any last bits of wisdom before our time is up?
Eat your vegetables.
I'll take that.
All right. Well, thanks, Kelly Sue. We'd really like everyone, and we encourage everyone to add Pretty Deadly and really all of Kelly's books to your pre-order lists, either digital or print. But pre-orders are very important to the longevity of comics these days, so make sure you do that. And
unfortunate and broken system, but that's the best we've got. So
we can't stress enough that the pre-orders, especially for independent books, are so important. Well, thanks everyone for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Our show notes, subscription details for the show, and information about submitting your nerd confessions and nerd stories are, as always, on the website at comicstherapy.com. See you next week. I believe in miracles. 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 I see miracles. 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 Because everybody's looking